On today's program, we begin with a magic show. Because if there's ever a medium that's made for magic, it's radio, right?
Hey guys, how you doing?
The magician's name is Alex Stone.
Wow. Okay, so I'm going to start out with something really simple. Maybe some of you have seen it, maybe you haven't, and then we'll go from there and maybe get a little more sophisticated and more complicated.
And the audience is kids, a bunch of middle schoolers from IS 318 in Brooklyn.
Have seen this or not, but I'm just going to take a handkerchief here. Do you want to check it out? Make sure it's normal, nothing weird. I only blew my nose in it like just once. It's okay.
With the thumb of his right hand, Stone stuffs a handkerchief into his left hand, and then...
Watch.
Yeah, you've seen this before.
It's gone.
It disappears. Okay. But then he reaches behind one kid's ear and pulls out the handkerchief.
If I reach out, there it is. I think I can get it. I can catch it. See?
Did you feel that come out of your ear?
No.
Where did it come from?
I don't know.
Now they try to figure out the trick.
Does anybody have any guesses?
His sleeve.
His sleeve?
Sleeves are rolled up, okay?
What do you got?
He probably has, like, on his hand, he has, like, a pocket that he pulls it out.
Oh. Guys, getting warmer now.
They get warmer?
That's good thinking. That's.
And then they get hot.
And it involves your thumb.
What's your name?
Jennifer.
Jennifer. Jennifer, give everyone Jennifer a round of applause.
Stone reaches into his right front pants pocket.
So check this out.
And pulls out.
See that?
A fake thumb.
Yeah, it's a fake thumb. It's called the thumb tip. It's one of the most valuable tools in magic. There's thousands of tricks you can do with it. And it's pretty darn obvious once you know it's
Man,
there.
Very obvious. But, now it looks like
But
and
magicians
sore
have
thumb.
Even, just to prove how no one knows, sometimes they'll do it with like a red one or a metal one. No one notices. You're not looking for a fake thumb, right? And that's how it works. And then it's gone, and then bring it back just like that.
Now, we had also invited some adults to see this magic show. How well did they figure out the trick?
I was with the sleeve theory, but clearly that's wrong.
I was wondering if it could be related to the ring at all.
Oh, the ring.
Totally.
Can we see
off.
The ring for a second?
That's really the dumbest theory ever. That's so stupid. Go home.
So we asked the kids why they seem to do better than the adults.
I think kids could think out of the box.
Maybe adults are more serious than kids. When you went to the adults, they didn't have any clue.
Because they're focusing on the handkerchief instead of the thumb.
None of this was surprising to Alex Stone. He's seen it all before, and he says other magicians have too. If you are a magician and your life depends on fooling an audience of adults versus an audience of kids, you would choose the adults every time.
There's a sense that when a kid watches a trick, they're asking a question every second. They're really approaching it with this sort of constant sense of curiosity and constant sense of sort of trying to understand what's going on. And I feel like their brains are just always awake when they're watching it.
All right, then. If kids tend to be more curious and more alert when it comes to magic, what about the rest of life? What about coming up with good ideas, even solving problems? Is it possible that we'd all be better off if we could think like a child?
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Steve Levitt is my Freakonomics friend and co-author. Not long ago, we published a book called Think Like a Freak. The idea was to help people think more like us, if that's your thing. More productively, more creatively, more rationally. That's the ambition, at least. I asked Levitt what his favorite chapter was in the book.
So I'm going to give you a childish answer to that question, which is that my second favorite chapter in the book is to think like a child. Because most adults wouldn't answer any question by telling you what their second favorite thing is. But that's the kind of thing that a child might do all the time. And I think that the beauty of thinking like a child and the beauty of that chapter in our book is that sometimes doing things differently and simply and with a kind of joy and triviality leads you to a really special place that as an adult you don't get to go to very often.
Hey, Livett, let's talk about some of what we label the characteristics of thinking like a child, like the good characteristics of thinking like a child that adults might want to smuggle into adulthood because they're productive. So thinking small. So when adults think about problem solving, most of us kind of shy away from the little ones because we figure they won't look important or whatnot, and the big ones really need our help. So talk about the power of thinking small.
I think there's a temptation to try to be something special and to take on a big problem. But it's actually getting into the realm of thinking about a tiny little question that maybe you could come to the answer to, and maybe once you learn the answer, would actually tell you about a lot of other things you might be interested in, might be able to generalize. Actually, I'll tell you the best example I can think of my own research of thinking small was the research we did on the Bagel Man.
The Bagel Man was a guy named Paul Feldman. He's a retired economist who started a business delivering bagels to different companies around Washington, D.C. He used an honor system payment setup, a wooden box with a slot where you'd put the money. In our first book, Freakonomics, we analyzed the Bagel Man's payment data and wrote up the findings, what the payment rates told us about honesty as it relates to the size of a company, time of year, company morale, things like that.
And I'll never forget a seminar I gave at the University of Chicago where one of my colleagues, a really smart colleague, his name is Luigi Zingales, he came to the seminar and I said, I'm going to talk to you today about this guy who sold bagels. And he blurted out, oh, this is ridiculous. What could I possibly learn from one guy and what he does selling bagels? And I said, maybe you'll be surprised. Bear with me. And I have to say, at the end of the seminar, Luigi raised his hand and he said, I didn't think it was possible, but I actually think I learned something general from what you just taught me about the Bagel Man. And that was actually, I would say that ranked as one of the top 10 moments I've ever had in academics, because I really believed it was true that by thinking small, I had learned something from the Bagel Man and that others could too.
Something else that kids do is they will state facts or describe something that's pretty obvious. Whereas adults, we tend to think that, well, if it's obvious, it indicates that we aren't thinking very hard. Talk about the power of acknowledging the obvious.
The best examples I've seen about stating the obvious have all come in a business context. So I'll come in as an outside consultant, and people in the company will think I'm the academic. I'm going to have these really complicated ideas and do complex econometrics. And really, the biggest values that I've ever added to firms comes usually on the first day I'm talking to them, when I know absolutely nothing, and I ask a question or make a statement which is so dumb and so obvious that no reasonable person could ever propose it. And a lot of times it's because it is so obvious and people who have been doing it for so long they think about it a different way, and it would be embarrassing. It would be embarrassing to ask the questions I ask. And a lot of times it is embarrassing because it is such an obvious or a dumb question. But every once in a while, it turns out that that obvious question is the absolute breakthrough. It's the thing that once you step back and look at it through the lens of in this case, a childlike ignorance, it opens you up to seeing what the truth is.
Okay, so Levitt, kids spend a lot of their time playing and otherwise having fun. Adults, out of duty and out of necessity, spend considerably less, so at least most adults. What's the advantage of keeping your eye on fun or injecting fun in your work, even for something as, you know, serious-ish as public policy? Why is fun something that's underutilized or could be utilized better?
I think fun is so much more important than people realize. And I've seen it in academics. When I interview young professors and try and decide if we should hire them, I've evolved over time to one basic rule. If I think they love economics and it's fun for them, then I'm in favor of hiring them. And no matter how talented they seem otherwise, if it seems like a job or effort or work, then I don't want to hire them.
Well, persuade me that they won't just be nice to have around because they love fun, but that having fun at what you do actually makes you better or different in some way that's positive.
Yeah, enjoying what you do, loving what you do is such a completely unfair advantage for anyone you're competing with who does it as a job. Because people who love it, they go to bed at night thinking about the solutions. They wake up in the middle of the night and they jot down the ideas. They work weekends. It turns out that effort is a huge component of success in almost everything. We know that from practice and whatnot. And people who love things work and work and work at it because it's not work. It's fun. And so my strongest advice to young people trying to figure out what they want to do is I always tell them, try to figure out what you love, okay? And especially something that you love that other people don't love. Sure, everyone wants to be a rock star. Everyone wants to be in the movies, but that's terrible. You don't want to compete head on. Find some, if you love ants, go study ants because no one else loves ants and you'll have a big advantage over the people who are just studying ants because they can't think of what else to do.
The E.O. Wilson crush continues.
Yeah, E.O. Wilson's a perfect. So E.O. Wilson was one of my mentors in college. And indeed, that's what he did. He loved ants more than anything. And he became the world's greatest expert on ants. And he had a great career and not just success, but joy. He got true joy. I mean, that was the thing that inspired me about E.O. Wilson. Even as he was in his 70s and his 80s, he loved what he did. He loved ants.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, if you're a scientist studying the way kids think, what do you learn?
It's exactly the opposite of what we used to think is an easy way to describe it.
And what else can we learn from that magic show?
With kids, you get this sense that at every step of the way, they're trying to understand it. And from the second they see it, they're always coming up with theories.
And if you want more Freakonomics Radio, check out our podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or on iTunes.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
You will remember at the start of this show that we brought in a magician to do some tricks for kids and adults.
Well, my name is Alex Stone.
That's him.
And I'm a journalist, author of a book on magic and science called Fooling Houdini, and a lifelong magic enthusiast and performer.
So on the scale of 1 to 10 of magic expertise, with me being a 0, let's say 0 to 10, you're where? How good are you?
Well, that's a sensitive question. A lot of magicians would get angry if I...
But I know that you're not that kind of magician.
I'm probably somewhere in the 7.5
range, very good, but not a all-time great, not a Hall of Famer.
I mean...
But good.
I know a lot about magic.
One thing that a magician does a lot that you did a little bit today is misdirection, right? So talk about that and how vulnerable kids are versus adults.
Yeah, you know, what I find is that kids are better at paying attention to more than one thing. Their attention is more diffuse. Mm-hmm. Adults are really good at focusing on one thing and ignoring peripheral distractions, whereas kids are really good at sort of shotgunning their attention all over the place, which is a good way to learn. It's good when you're first learning how things work, when you're first exploring the world. But in magic, you really want the person to focus on one thing. You want to direct their attention to one particular thing so that they'll won't see what's going on, you know, in the shadows.
You want to seduce them so that you can trick them.
Exactly. I think it's also that they're approaching it with this curiosity and it's just like this sponge-like desire and that they're always making theories. That's the other thing. I don't feel like adults are like that. I sort of feel like they watch it and they're waiting for the punchline and then they sort of see it. And then they maybe go back and think about it. With kids, you get this sense that at every step of the way, they're trying to understand it. And from the second they see it, they're always coming up with theories. Oh, it was in his sleeve. Oh, he had a fake thing in his hand. And they come up with theories that, you know, adults just aren't doing that.
You're much more likely to be able to manipulate adult attention than you are to be able to manipulate children.
That's Allison Gopnik.
I'm a professor of psychology and philosophy at the University of California at Berkeley.
Gopnik does not study magic. What does she study?
Young children's minds, particularly how it is that young children can manage to learn as much as they do about the world as quickly as they do.
She's also written books about her research. The Philosophical Baby was one. The Scientist in the Crib was another. Gopnik's work reinforces what the magician Alex Stone told us, that children tend to see things fundamentally differently than adults.
They're not very good, as we all know, at just focusing on one thing. They get distracted incredibly easily. They notice anything that's interesting or that changes or that they might learn from in their environment. And that makes them worse subjects of magic. When I wrote my book, I had a beautiful letter from someone who was actually a store detective. And he said one of the things that he'd do was he'd perch up on top of a balcony, up on the top of the store floor, and then he'd look at what people were doing below him. And he said what would happen is you'd see people walking along this floor, and someone would be holding the hand of a three-year-old, and then the three-year-old would look up and would see him on the balcony and would wave and say hello. And the adults never did that. It never even occurred to the adults to look up on the balcony and see what was there.
Can you summarize what we've learned and a little bit about how we've learned it, about how children think and especially establish things like causal understandings?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of easy. It's exactly the opposite of what we used to think is an easy way to describe it. So people used to think that children were illogical. And what we've discovered is that even little babies are capable of making logical deductions. A really dramatic one is that people have thought that even adults are terribly bad at understanding probability. Well, it turns out that babies and very young children, if you give them the problems in the right way, are actually amazingly good at doing probabilistic inference. Let me give you one more example. The conventional wisdom has been that children are egocentric and they can't take the perspective of other people. And one of the really dramatic things we've discovered is that, again, even infants are capable of figuring out what's going on in someone else's mind and figuring out how they think and feel about the world.
Okay, so you've given us a number of traits that children exhibit in much larger measure than we might have thought before. What about the ways in which the old wisdom was right? What are the ways in which children really are kind of a dormant or latent version at best of what they will become?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the kind of conventional wisdom was really that children were sort of defective grown-ups. Mm-hmm. So they were grown-ups but missing pieces with, you know, bits that hadn't developed yet. But if you think about that from a biological or an evolutionary point of view, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. An alternative way that you might think about them is think of the kids as being like the research and development division of the human species. And we're adults, we're production and marketing. So from the production and marketing perspective, it might look like the R&D guys are really not doing anything that looks very sensible or useful. They, you know, sit around all day in their beanbag chairs playing Pong and having blue sky ideas. And we poor production and marketing people who are actually, you know, making the profits have to subsidize these guys. But of course, one of the things that we know is that that kind of blue sky, just pure research actually pays off in the long run.
So I can imagine that an adult listening to you say these things would say, sure, that makes sense. That resonates with me. I believe that children have these traits in maybe a different shape or dimension than the traits I have. But I think it's probably hard for most adults to think about the idea that there are traits that are valued as in adults that children may actually be better at than adults.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about that. Are there some that would fit that category?
Part of the reason why we adults are really good at learning things quickly is because we already know a lot about the world. So when you look at how adults learn, the way that we typically learn is we take all those things that we've already learned and we already know, and they weigh really, really heavily in our decision-making and in the kinds of solutions that we're going to consider. And then maybe we have a little new evidence, but most of the time we sort of ignore it, or we might just tweak a little bit what we already think. But, you know, mostly the way our brains are is they're not broke, so we don't want to fix them. They are working just fine. We'll just leave them the way they are.
And implicit in that is that we have this strong set of priors, right? Prior beliefs that we act on. And we also, I guess, implicit in what you're saying is that we have a lot of heuristics. We have a lot of shortcuts that we've learned work well enough. And so we do them always, right?
Exactly. Let me give you an example in the universities, for example, it's a good example, my world, we give lectures. And the origins of that are the days when there weren't printed books, so that you had one manuscript and the professor was reading from the manuscript because the students didn't have books. That's literal. It is literally a medieval instructional technique. But we've been doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's kind of what you do when you're a faculty member. And the fact that we have no evidence at all, and in fact we have some evidence to the contrary, for this being a good way to get anybody to learn anything, doesn't keep us from doing it. Mostly we're doing it because we've always done it.
Right. The students aren't dying of boredom, at least. They may be bored, but they're not dying. And when you ask yourself the question of why do we do it, what does even a very smart person say? How does a very smart person answer that question for themselves?
Yeah, I think what they say is, well, we've kind of always done it, and it seems to work okay, and we're good at doing it. And I think here's the most relevant thing. It would take so much work to try and think through all the alternatives and try them out and see which ones work and which ones don't. That would just be such an effort that even if maybe in the long run it would be a bit of an advantage in terms of my short run utilities, and in particular just for me, it's not going to make a difference. I think the general picture, you know, when you talk about risks as adults, when we're trying to decide on a course of action, we're always balancing the risks and utilities, whether that's a risk to my reputation or my ego or my future interactions with other people or just a risk to, you know, my profit margin. And kids aren't in that world of, or at least if they're being taken care of properly, they're not in that world of risk and utility calculations. That liberates them. That frees them to, as we say, play. And we just sort of take for granted, yeah, of course kids play. But what play means, what do you mean when you say someone's playing? You mean they're doing something without really having a specific goal, without having to worry about whether it's going to be productive or not.
So where do all these wonderful and productive, potentially at least, childlike traits go? Do they magically evaporate? Is there a switch in our genes that kind of clicks over at age 21 and we stop thinking this way? What happens?
What we're trying to figure out now is exactly the answer to that question. So one thing that could happen is just that we all have the same brains, but as we accumulate more and more information, and we know that this happens, that some of the pathways get strengthened and become more efficient, and then other pathways just are what's called pruned. They just disappear. So it could be that it's just a matter of as we get to know more and become more efficient, we lose the capacity for flexibility. But it could also be that there's something about being a child, about having that particular childlike mind and brain, that is the thing that's letting you explore more and in some sense be more creative, and that there are things that we could do even as adults that put us back into that kind of state.
A state that's kind of magical, maybe? We went back to Alex Stone. What was your favorite moment of your magic show today?
I loved how quickly they figured out the card trick, the double lift. I mean, that was just bam. And God, adults never figure that out. I'm going to give the deck a shuffle. I don't know if you guys can hear. I'm shuffling here. I'm going to give the deck a cut. Jose,
this trick is called the ambitious card. Alex Stone asks one kid to pick a card,
three of diamonds,
and place it back in the deck. Then Stone shuffles the deck, but somehow the kid's card makes it back to the top of the deck.
Turn over the top card. Yeah, okay. This trick kind of tells a story, and the story is that no matter how many times you try to bury this card, it's kind of like a Houdini escape told in miniature. No matter how many times you try to take this card and put it in the middle of the deck, it's ambitious. That's why it's called the ambitious card. It always wants to pop back up to the top, always. And you keep doing it, and then every time you do it, it gets more and more amazing.
Again, it didn't take long for the kids to figure out the trick.
Where'd it come from? How'd it happen?
He has a different card on top.
The ambitious card, like a lot of tricks, relies on a double lift. That's when the magician presents two cards as if they're one. The kids figured it out.
She just busted your whole act.
Get the heck out of here! All right, good job. You still don't know.
Understand.
They still can't figure it out. Even after they have it explained to them. Yeah.
The grown-ups need more help.
So I'm curious if your observation that kids are more perceptive when it comes to magic has led you to consciously try to kind of engage or magnify any kid-like traits in your life as an adult?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like what? Name some?
Like, I love listening to the Bach lute suites. You know, especially the John Williams on guitar. And when I'll listen to that, or I like any kind of classical music that's sort of multi-voiced, try listening to the lute suites and always focus on the bass. Because the bass is always less, you're less conscious of the bass, right? Because the higher frequency notes are always the ones, they're the lead notes. It's like, you know, when you're listening to a song and there's a singer singing high, you're drawn to that. That's the flash of light and the magic. So that's the hand that's waving the handkerchief. So when you force yourself to sort of focus on the bass, what I find at least is that it kind of levels out everything else. It kind of turns down the sort of middle voice and the high voice. And you end up sort of, I find, hearing everything sort of simultaneously. And it allows you to kind of divide your attention so that you're experiencing the piece as a whole. You're hearing all the voices more clearly. And it's hard to do it at first, actually, because your attention keeps snapping back to the high voice. But if you kind of train yourself to do it, I think it brings out a richness in the music that's amazing, because then you really start to hear everything at once. And that's kind of the same idea as focusing on the hand that's not doing so much in the magic trick.
So thinking like a child can be productive, at least in some circumstances, but sometimes the way children think can be frustrating, especially for their parents. So what do you do about that? How do you get your kids to do the things you think they should be doing? Our next story looks into whether perhaps you should, you're going to hate me for saying this, whether you should just bribe your kids. Hello, John List.
Stephen Dubner. How you doing, man?
I'm great. How you doing?
Great, great.
John List is an economist at the University of Chicago, and he's a family man. Five kids. Now, do you ever have to bribe any of your kids? I'm just curious, John.
Every now and then I have to incentivize them. I don't call it bribing. I call it incentivizing them. My kids refuse to eat seafood. So, this comes directly from my wife, who claims to have gotten a bad piece of fish when she was a third grader. But I'm a big seafood lover, and we were in the Bahamas about 6 months ago. And I thought of an incentive scheme for my kids that included a large sum of money if they would eat fish for 7 consecutive days.
And how'd that work out?
Yeah, 3 of the 5 kids it worked for. They collected the money. And I was hoping then that they would acquire a taste for seafood. They would say, you know, Dad, that whitefish is actually pretty good. Or, you know, one time we had crab legs. But no, 0 of 5 for the long run. The minute we touched ground back here in the States, kids have not touched fish since, even the 3 of 5 who were eating the fish down in the Bahamas.
How much did they get from you?
I better talk about that off air. Put it this way, a lot of money.
But so those three of them at least played you pretty well, though.
Well, I don't know about playing me. They responded to the incentives. They ate the fish. But
your incentive in giving them that big cash bounty was not just to get them to eat it for the week, presumably.
Absolutely.
Right?
I wanted to modify their long-term behavior. And it's hard to, it's just a lesson that it's really hard to change habits.
So, is it possible to bribe kids to eat the foods you want them to eat? And even if it's possible, is it desirable? We'll talk about how bribing incentives may work with all kinds of behaviors. Now, you just heard John List describe his failure to bribe, excuse me, to incentivize his kids to eat something they didn't want to eat. That was his experience as a parent. So you might think that as an economist, John List also doesn't believe that incentives can change the way kids eat. But you'd be wrong. List recently ran a field experiment in Chicago, along with another economist, Anya Samick.
Okay, so what we're trying to do is understand what kinds of small behavioral nudges or education we can use to actually improve children's food choices.
That's Samick. She is at the University of Southern California.
And we're using this after-school program called the Kids Cafe. And there are 24 of these in the city of Chicago and surrounding area. Kids come there, they receive some help on their homework, and then they're given free food. And what we do is we randomize these different kids' cafes. And when I say randomize, I mean we randomly put different kids' cafes into different treatments. We have one treatment where we tell the kids' cafe, just carry on as you are. But at the end of the food choice, we're going to give kids a second choice. It's going to be over which dessert to have. And they can either have the healthy dessert or they can have the less healthy one.
And what are the two desserts you're offering, the healthy and the less healthy?
So the healthier dessert, this is actually a good question. We thought about this for a long time. And the healthy dessert is a cookie. I mean, I'm sorry.
Wishful thinking.
The unhealthy dessert is a cookie.
What kind of cookie?
We really were quite careful, and we chose a low-sugar whole wheat cookie.
Ooh,
and so the reason
come
we did
on.
That,
that's the good one?
We didn't feel comfortable going in and giving 1,500 kids who were at risk for obesity a really high sugar, delicious cookie.
Okay. All right.
The healthy dessert then, we again ran into a problem. So we really wanted to use fresh fruit. And unfortunately, because of the logistics of how this food is delivered, which is actually another big problem with the way that we deliver food to kids in these school lunchroom settings, is that we couldn't get fresh fruit there, and so we had to use dried fruit.
Mm, which has sugar concentration problems of its own that fresh fruit doesn't have, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So one thing we can't do is say that for this particular 1,500 kids, we really improved their nutrition, because all we did is we observed their choices, and all we needed to do is believe that most kids are going to choose the cookie. And that's the less healthy option. And that's exactly what happened.
Okay. So all else equal, you've got 1,500 kids roughly. They have their meal, and then they do homework and maybe hang out and play a little bit. And then at the end, they're having this a snack with a dessert with a choice, yes?
Yeah.
Okay. And just describe to me how the experiment itself is set up. How is the choice set, constructed?
So we announce to kids that they get a choice of this dessert, and we tell them they can only choose one item and that they have to eat it there in the cafeteria. And then we come around and we have these trays in which we have a large number of cookies and a large number of fruit, and then we just have kids choose one. All of these kids, we know all their names. We record exactly what they've selected, and that's our control group.
Okay. And you're doing this for a few days, a few weeks to establish the baseline? How does that work?
We come in twice, and we have kids make this choice, and what we find is that less than 20% of kids are choosing healthy. And then we come in for a period of 5 more days, in which we now have these treatment schools actually receive incentives or education. And what we find there, we come in, we read all this information about the food pyramid. So we tell kids, look, you really should choose the fruit. Fruit's really good for you. We have this campaign. It's called Eat Strong. So we tell them you should eat strong. You're going to be strong on the playground. You're going to learn more at school. It's going to be very good for you. This is really good for your health. The USDA recommends that you eat more fruit.
Okay.
And we show them the food pyramid. So we have all these posters. We walk around. We show them these posters with the food pyramid. And kids don't improve their food choice at all.
Okay. So teaching them doesn't improve their choices or doesn't change their choices. Now, before we declare that a dead end, do we know that this mode of education was a good one? Or maybe, like when you're telling me that, if you tell me that if I eat this little cup of raisins and dried apricots and I'm going to be like a stud on the playground and a superstar in the classroom, I'm just going to say, Anya, you seem nice, but I don't believe you. That doesn't sound compelling to me. Do we know if the education is actually considered legitimate by them?
Well, it's the education that you would administer if you went on the USDA website and pulled off their informational materials.
Right. No, I know that, but I'm saying maybe the USDA isn't so good at this. I realize I'm throwing a stupid thing in the middle of your smart thing, but that's the way I think.
No, so obviously we could be using the wrong education. That's true. So we can't say much about whether it's the right education or not. But what we can say is that we give them this education. We tell them all about how healthy fruit is. Mm-hmm. And 8 out of 10 kids still choose a cookie.
Okay. All right. So that's not working so well. What else do you have up your sleeve?
So we come in and we have these incentives that we thought we didn't even know what to do with these incentives because they were a little bit lame. So we just had these pens. We had these rubber bracelets. And then we had these tiny plastic trophies that just said, I ate strong.
Mm-hmm.
And we told kids, if you choose the fruit and you eat it, you get to pick out one of these prizes. And now we have 8 out of 10 kids who are choosing the fruit.
Oh, my God. For plastic trophies and pens and rubber bracelets.
That's right. So these things are very popular. They're very cheap, so they cost us less than a dime each. And kids are choosing healthy, and they don't have any education about why they should be choosing healthy, at least from us. But now we've really improved food choice.
Now, how do we know this is not just a novelty, that it's the first time they get offered the incentives? Or does it not even matter? Is it just a matter of kind of switching the habit or the preference?
Well, it actually works every time. So we come in 5 times, and every time we have these really high rates of selection of the fruit.
And do they actually eat the fruit then? Or do they just...
They have to eat it.
They have to eat it.
To get the toy, yeah. They have to eat it.
And did you check their cheeks and so on, like in prison, to make sure they swallowed? Or they're sticking it under the table? Or it doesn't go that far?
We were actually pretty careful. So this study took a lot of undergraduates from the University of Chicago who were walking around and monitoring these kids.
Okay. So what did the researchers take away from this experiment?
Overall, all of these studies really show, first of all, that you can make a small change in a school setting, in a food setting for kids, and have it have a big impact on choices. It shows that education is not enough. We actually do find when we combine education with incentives that that has the strongest long-term effect, which I didn't address earlier, but that's an important point, that in addition to education, we need to really give kids a moment where they can make a choice. And that's the moment where we can provide a nudge, where incentives can act as a great nudge for that.
If I'm a restaurant, I want to sell a lot of food. I want to make the money that I'm able to make. If I'm the government, I think especially as I'm paying more and more for people's health care long term as the government, I want to keep people healthier. And therefore, I have an interest in getting people to eat more nutritiously. So I can put some pressure on restaurants to either serve more nutritious food, serve less food, or help them somehow come up with a scheme to at least educate people or make them a little bit more likely to eat more nutritious food. So I can have calorie counts or maybe even subsidize healthier food choices. That seems to be fairly viable. Yeah. Do you see evidence of that kind of thing going on and working well?
One project we have that is very effective, it's a small nonprofit grocery store on the south side of Chicago called Louis Groceries. And we've gone in and we've been running studies in which we give adults incentives for choosing at least 5 fresh fruits and vegetables in their cart. And we're actually giving them $1 for every 5 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables they buy in a shopping trip. And we're comparing that to another treatment in which adults are just receiving some educational information about why it's important to eat fruits and vegetables. And there we see almost the same results that we're seeing with these kids. So in a real environment where adults are making decisions about purchasing, incentives really work.
So the takeaways here seem to be that fruit must be subsidized, whether dried or fresh, yes?
Right.
And that kids can be bribed successfully.
Yeah. Well, adults can be bribed successfully too.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio. So we can incentivize choices that benefit society, at least in some cases, but why should we have to?
You know, I think that this is one of the most important issues that humanity faces, is making this trade-off between doing something costly now that will benefit me or humanity in the future. Things like staying in school, things like saving for retirement, things like adopting green technologies.
Also, if you like this show, maybe you should subscribe to the Freakonomics Radio podcast. You can find us on iTunes or wherever podcasts are given away.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We heard Anya Samick describe the field experiment she worked on with John List.
I'm John List, and I'm a professor at the University of Chicago's Economics Department.
What exactly does John List do?
And what I do is I go out into the real world and try to change it for the better using field experiments.
Well, that sounds pretty simple. Can you give me an example?
Very simple. So let's talk about the simple example that we're talking about today. What we're after is we're trying to explain or describe, first of all, the consumption choices of the underprivileged children in America. And once we see the types of foods that they're consuming, which is not a great thing, you know, if they have a choice between a cookie and a bowl of fruit, they choose the cookie. So our idea is to go out
now,
can I just interrupt you
for 1 second there? Is it fair to say that this is the kind of poor choice, relatively poor choice that an underprivileged kid makes? Or is that the same choice that, you know, a mediocrely privileged adult would make as well? In other words, is this a function of childhood
absolutely.
Or is this? I'm just curious to know what you know about food choice in children versus adults generally.
Yeah. So I think that this is a general problem, but you have the problem in an even stronger way amongst the underprivileged who have less resources to use to purchase and consume healthier foods. So when I say underprivileged, I think this is our experimental testing ground, but nevertheless, you do have the same problem throughout society. You have kids, you know, running an obesity rate about 1 in 5 across America, and in urban settings, the obesity rate is a little bit higher than that. But the general point here about all of this is that you have many problems where what you do now affects what happens later. And usually we choose the easier decision or the easier action now. You think about savings for retirement. You think about getting doctor checkups. You think about going to school. You think about engaging in risky behaviors. You think about adopting green technologies for our houses. In all of these cases, we usually choose the bad action. And that action is to do what's best for us now to the detriment of the future or to the detriment of our future self. And nutritional choices right now are just one of these elements that we face in society where we need kids to recognize the choice that you make now will critically affect your outcome in the future.
There's an idea, quite prevalent in our society, that if we can only teach people that they are making poor decisions now that will adversely affect them later, well, they'll make better decisions now. But the experiment that John List and Anya Samick did in Chicago, trying to get kids to eat healthier snacks, showed that an educational message didn't work at all, at least not in that setting. So, maybe it's reasonable to think that educational messaging isn't as potent as we think.
Right. I think in just about every walk of life, we have messages like, get out to vote. You know, it's your duty to vote. We had messaging in the States on smoking for decades. And now, you know, with a combination of changing the prices of smoking. And what I mean by that is increasing the tax rates on purchases of cigarettes, along with messaging, those together formed a very important duo to curb smoking in the United States. But when you look at other countries, just go to Europe, you can see that smoking is alive and well in Europe. And they surely have the same information that we have on the detrimental effects of smoking. But I think in every walk of life, you have people saying, stay in school, don't do drugs. You know, messaging has a really hard time working And I think by and large, because the recipient of those messages is not a demander of that information. And if you're not a demander, you will have very little use for that information. You know, people say we should be green. We're ruining the planet because of carbon emissions, global warming. But again, that's a problem where if we curb our consumption of carbon now, that hurts us. That hurts our economic growth. And we're not going to see the advantages for 50, 100, 150, or 200 years. People don't want to make that trade-off between now and then.
Do you think that policymakers and other, incentive creators are starting to get the message that educational messaging, especially when it's got a sort of moral tone to it, is not very effective? Or do you see people in the academic and research realms where you live who understand this quite fully just look out at those policymakers and say, oh boy, they really don't get it yet?
Right. I sort of see both. On the one side, you have policymakers who don't get it. On the other side, you have policymakers who really do get it, but that's really the only tool at their disposal. You see, using messages is cheap. You have government agencies. Right now, I'm working with the UK government to try to convince people to pay their taxes. You have many people who have not paid their income taxes in the UK. And the UK government sends out letters to them every year telling them, please pay your taxes. So they ask us, can you run some field experiments with us to help convince people to pay their taxes? And we propose all kinds of different incentive schemes, you know, fines, jail time, all these fun things that economists dream about. And the policymakers say, we can't do that. We can't change law. But what we can do is we can add those two cool sentences that you used back in your 1998 study, and we can use those two sentences, which are on moral suasion, to try to get people to pay their taxes. So you see, they're smart enough to know this might not be a great tool. Yeah,
but it's the best they have.
Yeah, and it's not very costly, and that's important to them.
So, John, is the takeaway message of your study that it's better to bribe kids to eat healthy food than to just teach at them?
I think the message would be you want to do both. I think you do not want to use messaging alone. If you do use messaging, you should combine it with an incentive, because that will allow you to convince kids to make better choices, but it will also yield better consumption choices. I think we need to understand that this is a two-part problem, not only the choice, but the consumption. And what we find is that messaging along with incentives give you that outcome or that set of outcomes that you want.
Now, take what you learned from this study, which is that incentives work in terms of food consumption, and generalize it for me as much as you can, not only out of the experimental realm, but out of the childhood realm.
Right, absolutely. I think that this is one of the most important issues that humanity faces, is making this trade-off between doing something costly now that will benefit me or humanity in the future. Things like staying in school, things like saving for retirement, things like adopting green technologies. We have to convince people right now to make the right choice for, in many cases, themselves and also society. And I believe that a strong dosage of incentives combined with tasteful messaging will allow us to get to that point where we have people making the right choices now that will yield the right outcomes in the future. So when you think about all of our major problems, it's a trade-off through time. And you have kids who would rather skip school and go have fun when they're 16 years old than stay in a boring algebra class. It's a very simple point of calculus for them. They don't see that the future labor market returns are 12% for every year that they stay in school. When you're 16 years old, you don't even think about what's going to happen when you're 25, much less when you're 18. And we need to combine the correct basket of incentives to align the kid's choices with what society wants them to choose.
Okay, so that's all well and good to say, and even if one believes it, and I personally tend to pretty much believe what you're saying, what do you do? What is that basket of incentives for a 16-year-old who's teetering on the edge of dropping out or not going to school?
So it depends on what realm we're in. If we want to talk about education, I think the solution is changing the prices to education. What I mean by that is taking some of the future rewards that we as a society reap from the kids staying in school and not committing crime and going to jail, taking some of those rewards and giving them to the kids now, or giving them to the parents now to incentivize the parent to make sure that the child stays in school, takes school seriously, and goes on and gets the right education to help society in the future. That might be different than our food choices, for example, because we're not talking about 16-year-olds now in our food experiment. We're talking about 6-, 7-, and 8-year-olds. Incenting a 6-, 7-, and 8-year-old with dollars doesn't make any sense. You know, you have to choose, again, the right incentives. We chose toys. Things like rubber ducks really turned a 7-year-old on. So I think in each case, there is not a silver bullet, but nevertheless, in each case, in the long run, we need education because, like I said, habits are what keep you going. And I think the education and information change beliefs, but only over generations. I think now you have my kids who are coming home and telling me, "Papa, you better not smoke that cigar because it's really bad to smoke." When I went home and saw my mom smoking, I never thought that it was a problem smoking. But now our kids, they're actually programmed to think that smoking is a really bad thing. That has taken place over generations. And that's where I think information and education works over the long run when we change habits. But you need initial incentives to change the motivations of our kids now. We just don't want two generations of lost children because we couldn't change their habits. We need to change the motivations now, and I think incentives will do that.
We end today with a question sent to us from a young reader of the Freakonomics blog. His name is John. Here is what John wanted to know. What is it like being an economist? I'm 16, and I don't know what I want to do when I grow up. I haven't found my, quote, passion, end quote, yet, besides video games and reading this blog, LOL, he says. I am insanely smart, though. I guess that helps. Thanks. All right, what do you have for him, Levitt? Why don't you give us a day in the life of you as the economist, and then why don't you tell us how a day in the life of you as an economist differs from what most people think an economist actually does?
Yeah, so there are different stages in the life cycle of an economist. If you're studying to be an economist in college, it's really fun because much of college economics is about ideas and new concepts, and you learn about different areas. And it's really was an exciting time for me, and I think for many people who study economics. Then you got to go get a PhD, and boy, that is hard work because it's very mathematical and very competitive, and boy, it is tough getting a PhD. Once you become a faculty member is pretty good. You teach a little bit, but mostly you just sit around in your office. And if you're a young economist, you are actually playing with the data yourself, trying to prove things and give seminars to other economists to try and convince them that you're right. Ultimately, when you get to be a little more famous and a well-resourced economist, then you get to have a bunch of RAs who they do all the stuff you used to do, research assistants, and they pore over the data and try to make sense of it. And then you have an even tougher job, which is how to figure out when your RAs are making terrible mistakes that are going to lead to your ruin of your reputation. Mostly being an economist is pretty boring. You're mostly sitting in a room alone, and you're mostly working on projects that are interesting to you but not really to anybody else in the rest of the world. I think you have to have passion. I mean, the guy who asked the question talked about not having passion for something. And if you do not have passion for economics, it absolutely is the wrong career to go into. Because even the people who start with passion, almost all of them get the passion beaten out of them pretty quickly. So I would tell that guy he should play fewer video games and go out and try as many different things as he can. And he's got to find a passion, but he's got to find a passion that nobody else shares or as few people share as possible. Because if only the world would pay you a six-figure salary to play video games, the young men in this country would be the happiest people anywhere in the world.
Thanks for listening to Freakonomics Radio. We'll be back next week with more things you always thought you knew but didn't, and things you never thought you wanted to know but do. Talk to you then.